ultimately, what are you capable of? Because if you're only trying to beat the person next to you, when in reality, you could be far ahead of them, but you're not even giving yourself the opportunity to try because you're so focused on them, like that does nothing for you. And it's the same, in a race, if you're behind or if you're ahead, not letting those emotions start to freak you out. Like, did I take it out too fast? Are they going to catch me? Do I have enough to catch them at the end? Like, it has to be about you and the way that you're going to compete and swim your best.
All right, welcome back or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, by trade and training a sport and performance psychologist, as well as the co-founder of Compete to Create. And the whole idea behind these conversations is to learn from people who are on the path of mastery. And we want to better understand what they're searching for. How do they organize their inner life? How do they explore? How do they make sense of things? Like, what do they really do in the interior to be able to explore mastery, both of self and craft? Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading. But it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Now, this week's conversation is with Missy Franklin, a 5-time Olympic gold medalist with 1 bronze medal as well. And she's a 2-time FINA World Swimmer of the Year. And FINA is the international federation that's recognized by the International Olympic Committee for administering international competitions in water sports. So that's a big time award to achieve. And at the age of 17, she swept the world stage. And if you watch the Olympics and you're familiar with swimming, you definitely saw her and understood what she did at such a young age. It was remarkable. And then 7 years later, she retired from swimming in December of 2018 after this incredible career. Missy was also named World Swimmer of the Year and American Swimmer of the Year by Swimming World magazine, and also earned the ESPY for Best Female Olympian in 2013 and Best Female College Athlete in 2015. How about that? She won an ESPY in 2013 before she was, you know, even ripping in college. Amazing. Missy won a gold medal in the 2016 Olympics, and she did it in the 4x200 relay, but viewed those games as one of the most challenging experiences of her life. And that's something that we touch on in this conversation. So Missy shares how she dealt with that first real adversity that she faced in her life and the depression that ensued. And in Missy's words, I mean, this is just beautiful how she puts this. It's not about whether or not someone's gone through more than you or whether or not someone's lost more or gained more. It's just about being human together and knowing that we all experience these emotions based on so many different things. I mean, it's right on. That spirit of humanity is right on. And regardless of our upbringing, our gender, our ethnicity, our economics, we're all going through something. We all experience setbacks, either internal setbacks or external obstacles. I mean, every one of us is just trying to figure it out. And I mean, I say that, and I guess only the self-aware would nod their head to that. Me and you, we're trying to figure this thing out together. And nobody, you know this, I know you know this, nobody lives this highlight reel perfect life. We are in this stuff together. And some days, some months, I mean, even some years are harder than others for you and for other people as well. And when we look within, when we really do that internal discovery work, we recognize our struggles, our sources of suffering. And in return, we become more compassionate for others, more kind, more supportive, more caring. I mean, stronger in so many ways for other people. Those are the people I want in my foxhole, and that's the person I want to be. I gotta tell you, I love this Finding Mastery community, and I love this conversation with Missy. And if you also love this podcast, you can do a couple things to help us out. Tell some friends, grab their phone, take a look at their phone, open it up, talk about one of the podcasts that you love, talk about this conversation with Missy, and then show them how to download it. Show them, you know, kind of where to make that experience come to life for them. And the other way is to support our sponsors. And you can find all the information and all the discounts and all the stuff that we're trying to curate for you at findingmastery.net/partners. And using those codes and links that we give for our sponsors, it tells them that you're coming from us, that you're, you know, part of our community, and that you're stoked to support their business and our business as well. And with that, let's jump right into this week's conversation with Missy Franklin. Missy, how are you?
I am so excited.
Oh, how yeah. are you? Here we go. God, this conversation has been something I've wanted to do with you for a long time. So thank you for making the time to do this.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. I've been a huge admirer for so long, and I'm so grateful for all the work that you've done and the lives that you've impacted in such an incredible and beneficial way. So really is an honor to talk with you. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, I think it speaks to this community. Like, the Finding Mastery tribe is like, they're crazy. And I mean that in an endearing way, you know,
right? Yes, crazy in the best way.
Yeah. And so, I think that you're a bit like this, but I don't want to put anything in your words, but just a little counterintuitive, a little off access, you know, just appreciating like the disruptive approach to the thing that you care most about. And you were a disruptor early on. And so before we get kind of into the weeds of what you've done, maybe we can start with your event to give context to people about your event. And then we'll go maybe backwards and take a look at early life and then some of the moments that highlight what you've done as a profession. But just talk about your event in the pool.
Absolutely. So literally just 200 backstroke. Is that what we're...
Well, okay. Take it a step further. Like, most people know what that is, but maybe not. Maybe not, you know, like, folks don't really appreciate the difference between breast and butterfly and backstroke and freestyle. So if you could just walk through your particular one. Yeah.
Of course. So that 200 backstroke is my main event. So that was kind of like my bread and butter. Every swimmer sort of has an event that is like their baby, that they just love a little bit more, whether it's because they're the best at it, it's their favorite, or it's the one that hurts the most and they just get the most satisfaction. But 200 back was that for me. But overall, I was a backstroker and a freestyler. So I did 100 and 200 backstroke and 100 and 200 freestyle. And the thing that I loved about being a freestyler is that also meant I was able to participate in relays. And same with the 100 backstroke. I was able to do medley relays with my 100 backstroke. And everyone knows me that relays are my favorite thing in the whole world, because being a part of a team has always meant more to me than anything else. So, but 200 backstroke was the event that I broke my first world record in short course meters when I was 16. It was my first individual long course world record in London in 2012. And that record stood for a little over 7 years. It was just broken. But it was, it's just four laps of excruciating pain and agony and total joy at the end.
Oh my God. Okay. So you throw it out there like a world title, no big deal. What was that like when you broke the world record?
My gosh. It was surreal. I think you dream about those moments so much and you envision them so often. You take the time to sit before a meet and think about your race and how you're going to swim it and what it's going to look like and what it's going to feel like to touch the wall and look up and see a world record. But to actually have it happen is just a completely different experience. It feels like you're still in that dream. It doesn't feel like reality. And to be honest, I don't know if those moments ever truly sink in. Like, even to this day, I don't know if I fully understand like everything that happened in that moment.
Wow. Okay. How much imagery did you do? Let's start with the easy question there. Cause it, obviously you did, you're describing visualization / imagery, but how much of it was part of your program?
So I did quite a bit of it and it was personally implemented. You know, I didn't really have coaches that were about enforcing that. They were more so just encouraging and, you know, if it helps you, do it. If it doesn't, don't. So for me, what I really had to do was swimmers and track athletes, and I'm sure other sports as well, but we go through something called taper. And it's in the weeks leading up to a big competition, our practices start to go down in volume and up in intensity. And so we're doing less, but we're hitting faster speeds and we're letting our body recover while still really just priming ourselves to be in best racing condition. And that was the best time for me to visualize because I was just so engaged in being ready for my competition. So my tapers were normally about a week and a half to 2 weeks long. And I would try and do imagery work almost every single day. And then once we got to the actual competition, I completely shut it down because A, if I tried to visualize before going to sleep, there would be no sleeping. And B, I just wanted to be like so present and engaged in the moment that I didn't want to try and create something in my head rather than just experiencing it for how I was meant to experience it.
You know what I appreciate about what you're saying is that it's a real skill. So we need to practice it. And it's a tool, meaning that when you use the tool right, there's an impact, there's an effect that comes from it. And it, when you do imagery right, at least my experience is that it lights up our central nervous system. And so doing it right before bed makes no sense. Like people say, when should I do it? Definitely not before bed.
The worst time.
No, because your heart rate's going to come up. You're going to see and feel something that matters a lot, that's electric. And when that takes place, you know, and right before bed, it's just counterintuitive. But so you would get your heart rate would come up and you would feel that animation inside your body when you would see and feel the images?
Oh, without a doubt, because I wanted that to be a part of it. I wanted to be able to anticipate and expect what I was going to be feeling in that moment, because, you know, with sports, with swimming, there truly is only so much that you can control. And I think that's really what every athlete is doing, is they're training so that they can be as prepared for what they can control while understanding that there is still going to be so much that is out of their control. So if I could control my emotions, if I could control how I was going to feel sitting in a ready room before I raced, if I could control those things that often even my competitors or other athletes like couldn't control, that was going to give me an edge.
And so what the way that you are doing it is to get like a free look at that environment, so whether it's exactly. The ready room or it's on the blocks or whatever it might be. You would shut down and close your eyes basically, and then animate and bring to life those sounds, shapes, smells, experiences. And then, you know, it sounds trite, but it really is a free look. Like there's no cost to it. You can make mistakes. You can sort it out. You can figure whatever. Yeah. And so how much time would you do it? Like, was it a 6 minute? Was it a hour? Was it somewhere in between? I just trying to create some wide boundaries.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. It would really depend. There were some days when I would literally just visualize a race start to finish. And I would actually try and time it perfectly. So I would in my head do the start and I would have my phone and I would start a stopwatch and I would actually try and visualize my race to the exact goal time that I wanted to go. So sometimes I just did it for those couple of minutes. Sometimes I did that until I got the time right. So it would be like 20, 30 minutes. And sometimes I visualized everything around the actual race, not the race itself, but how I would feel at the Olympic Village, how I would feel on the bus heading over, how I would feel during warm-up. So depending on what I was really focusing on, the length would definitely vary.
And could you feel it from a like a sensation standpoint, like, and I don't mean necessarily just the emotions, but could you feel the senses, the kinetic internal and external awareness as you were doing the skill or as you were walking on deck?
Oh yes, absolutely. Okay. And that's like, you talk about it being no cost. And when I'm walking out for my 200 backstroke final and all of my competitors are walking out for their race, and it's the first time that they're walking out for a 200 back final at the Olympic Games, it's my 50th time, because that's how many times I've imagined it, and that's how many scenarios I've played with, and how many situations that, oh, if something goes wrong, how am I going to handle it? If I slip on my start, how am I going to control it? If I miss a turn, like, so I felt prepared for anything, even though technically it was my first time walking out for a 200 back final at the Olympics, just like everyone else's.
That's what's up. Yeah. And you know what drives me nuts? And I'm going to bias your response probably, but it drives me nuts when people are looking for a trick, or they're looking for, you know, a hack, or they're looking for basically some sort of like little tiny tool. And what I hear you say, yes, imagery is a tool. It's a skill involved. But what I hear you say is, no one told me to do it. It was, but my life fundamentally was oriented around me figuring out how to be my best.
Yeah.
And like, please stop me if that's not the case. But it sounds to me like it's a fundamental orientation around that aim.
Oh, without a doubt. And I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, having a magic tool is the easiest option. And that's often what a lot of people are after, is what's going to be easiest, what's going to be most efficient, what's going to help me see the biggest change the quickest. And I don't think that long term, and if we're looking at being sustainable, like that's just not what's going to be in our best interest. And so it takes a lot of self-awareness and self-analysis to figure out, okay, if I do want to be my best, what are things that I'm going to have to start implementing in my own life every single day, not just a one-time, you know, trick, tool done. Now I'm going to be better. But what are practices I have to continually engage in that are actually going to change and mold and shape me to be better?
I love it. What is your, like, if I could go inside or behind your eyes or in your, like, in your heart area, what is that like for you? Because I watched you like, holy moly, just like you took this, you know, the whole industry by storm, really. And like, but I want to know what it was like inside.
It was just pure joy. Like, that's all you would have found, was just happiness. Like, a little bit of nerves, a little bit of excitement, a little bit of fear, but ultimately just joy. Like, I had dreamt of that moment my entire life. I drew a picture of myself on top of a podium at the Olympics winning a gold medal when I was 5 years old. And to think that 12 years later, that was actually happening, like, it was just so surreal. And I truly just wanted to take in every single moment because it was something I had dreamt of and worked for literally my entire life.
Wow. And then that imagery as a small, thin slice of preparation, because there's lots of preparations that you have to go through, right?
Definitely.
And it's just a small, thin slice. Was your North Star joy? Oh, it was. So that was the North Star, to walk on deck and to be the animation of joy.
Yes. And that was why I had the success that I did so early on in my career, is because, you know, people are always really surprised to find out that I don't feel like I'm that competitive of a person. And that's not normally what you expect to hear from elite level athletes, who are, of course, known for being the most competitive people in the whole world. But I think the more I've looked at my career and looked back, it was never only about me competing with everyone else around me. I was truly just so joyful, and I was so filled with happiness just to be doing what I loved every single day, that in and of itself was enough for me. Like, having that competition and that push and that drive is such a blessing. And I'm so grateful for all of the athletes I met along my journey that made me the athlete that I am. But ultimately, the fact that I just got to swim every day, that was enough.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, HYDROW.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption, They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you go check them out. You know, what's wild is that I think about swimming and it, to me, it feels a bit torturous, like staring at a black line.
You're not alone.
Yeah. Right. And so I swam as a kid and I wasn't going to stay with it. It didn't suit me, but I do like that feeling of like when there's people next to me and they're skilled. And it triggers something in me to say, wait a minute, dig deeper, understand better, align more properly, like figure out the efficiencies. I really like that part of it. But yeah. I want to understand for you, like, what was the joy about?
It was therapeutic. Swimming to me was like truly the best therapist I could have ever asked for, because no matter what kind of a day I had, no matter what kind of emotions I was feeling, when I walked into practice for the day, I knew that there was nothing I could do for the next 2 hours except get better in the water. And that was it. I couldn't solve anything I was worried about. I couldn't stress anymore about something I was stressing over. I had to be present for those 2 hours. And so it just gave me time every single day to just breathe and be present in that moment and just focus on getting better at the thing I loved most in the world.
Mm, okay. And at a young age, did you still have that same aliveness, that same joy, that same therapeutic experience?
Oh my gosh. Yes, absolutely. I did every sport imaginable growing up. My parents put me in everything. And I highly recommend that to all parents is put your kids in whatever they want to be put in, whatever they're interested in, because that's how they learn. That's how they figure out what they love and what they don't. And the only rule my parents had was you have to see a season through. So if I started a new sport and halfway through the season was like, I really don't like this anymore, I knew that I had made a commitment to my team and that I had to follow it through. And if after the season I wanted to stop, then I could stop. But I loved that because it really allowed me to do all these different things. And I loved basketball. I loved volleyball. I loved soccer. But at the end of the day, I knew after going through all of this, I loved swimming more than any of those things. And that was what brought me the most joy. And even as a 7-year-old, like that's where I felt my calling was. And I just could never get enough of it.
I can hear it in your voice now. And part of me, like I don't like to be a cynic, but sometimes I like to try to get in there and understand from different points of view.
Absolutely.
So the cynic angle would be, no, you just were really good at it. And it was easier than the other sports. And what you really liked was the adulation from adults. You liked standing a little bit taller than your peers on podiums because, who doesn't like that at a young age? And so, Like, can you push back on that? Because it's not, or say, yes, that's it, but like, or somewhere in between. But the thought that, and this is me, like, really, I want to believe exactly what you're saying. And then I also want to understand you were better. You were just better than people. And I'm not saying you didn't have to work hard, but you were, you were better.
Yeah. And I think there's a mix. Like I 100% agree with you in that if something does come easy to you and you're really good at it, it's pretty hard not to enjoy that. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was definitely part of growing up, but at hopefully I don't sound super precocious and incredibly cocky here, but I was just very athletic. So I was also really good at basketball, and I was also really good at volleyball. And like every sport that I tried, I felt like I could have excelled in those sports. And I never felt like swimming, I saw that much of a difference. Like I didn't think, oh, I could be even better in swimming than I could be anywhere else. It had nothing to do with what I thought I could be best at in comparison to people. It was truly what left me with the biggest smile on my face. And when you think about swimming, you know, practicing in the water for 2 hours a day, there's not, you know, crowds watching that. There's not people waiting at the end of your lane praising you for that every single day. Like, yeah, they'll maybe see you race every couple of weeks, and that's cool. But ultimately, if you're spending hours upon hours, day after day, week after week, with no one watching, and it's still bringing you as much joy as it brought me, like that's where I would push back on that.
Volumes. That, I mean, what you just said is volumes of like intensity. That's so clear to me now, is that you, and this is what I hear. No, I was really good. You know, I had options, but it was this one that didn't have much external reward. There was obviously the external reward race day, but the amount of work that goes into developing the skill was praiseless, was rewardless in many ways, other than the inherent joy that you had from, it sounds like, the exhausted suffering unlocking that would take place, and then getting out of the pool, the relief, the knowing. Like, it sounds like it's something in there that was really important for you.
Oh, I'm like grinning ear to ear just thinking about that feeling right now. Yeah. Like the best, still to this day, my favorite memories of swimming, particularly in college, were after Saturday morning workouts. Because here you had just gone through a grueling week of 10 plus swim workouts, 3 plus weight workouts, any additional dry land, and Saturday morning was always the hardest workout of the week. And we all got into the locker room, and I truly don't think Disneyland could have competed with how happy a swim team locker room is after Saturday morning practice. Like, we are just blasting music. We're hugging each other because we get the next day and a half off. And so we are just so happy and like just reveling in the work that we put in that week and everything we did, not only individually, but as a team to get better. And there really is no better feeling, like knowing you've earned, like really, really earned that reward that you're about to get, which for us in the season is just some downtime.
I mean, I when I said early on, like you're a bit off axis, like swimmers are weird, you know, like you guys are just like a breed of yourself that's like in an endearing way, but it's like, it's so different.
Oh yeah. We spend a lot of time in our own heads.
Yeah. Okay. So help me understand what the thing underneath it was for you. So yes, you get some relief from the intense work that you do, yeah, and you get some potential rewards from an external point on race day. But what was the thing underneath that you really were driven by?
It was the feeling of knowing there was nothing else I could have done to be better. That feeling to me, I have found it in little places, and it's amazing how that feeling goes so beyond athletics, and how in my retirement I've been able to see how that is applicable to so many areas of my life. But it's that feeling when you just know in your heart of hearts that if you had to go back and do it again, there's nothing else you could have done. There's not a percentage more of energy or effort that you could have given. Like, you could not possibly have given anything more than what you just did. And being able to look back on something and have that kind of a feeling, like, that is the best feeling in the world to me.
It's rare.
Exactly.
It's a rare experience.
It is so rare. And when it happens, like the sense of peace that comes with that and pride in yourself, it's pretty indescribable.
My experience has been that most people hedge their bet And that mm-hmm. hedge the bet comes in subtle ways, and it comes in sometimes not so subtle ways. But the subtlest, the most insidious, the sneaky way is and are the self-esteem saving mechanisms.
Yeah.
So let's pull it out of sport for a minute. Let's say you're in college and you got finals coming up, and you show up to the finals, and they're going to be hard, and maybe they're on a curve, and let's say that all the scores are shared, a little bit like swimming, right? And and you show up and you lean over to the person next to you on finals day for history, what doesn't matter, and you say, man, I had a tough night last night. Like I put the bottle down like around 11 o'clock and then I started studying.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? Yeah. Oh yeah. We were getting after it. What? You're drunk last night before the finals? Yeah. Well, we'll see how this goes. So why would anybody do that? Like what? But that is a thing that happens. And it's a subtle self-esteem saving mechanisms where people don't have to be vulnerable and put their chips on the table and, expose what they know and don't know because there's this other storyline or narrative. You're not built that way.
I don't think I am. And I've seen so many examples of that. And that was something that was so huge for me in Rio because London had been so successful for me. Rio was the complete opposite, just the biggest failure of my life. And everyone was looking for an excuse. Everyone wanted me to have some kind of a story. Like I didn't sleep well, I'm sick, I'm whatever it was. Like people almost wanted a scapegoat for me. And I was not okay with that. I was only okay with taking 110% of the responsibility that I was not performing the way that I was supposed to be performing. And I didn't know why. So I wasn't going to make up a reason and I wasn't going to complain about it. I was just going to tell every reporter and every media outlet that was asking me over and over and over again, I don't know. I'm just not performing the way that I'm supposed to be performing. And I'm trying to figure it out and I'm trying to work through it. And that, as hard as it was, allowed me to be the person that I always wanted to be in failure.
Mm. Okay. So you had an image of how you wanted to be, let's call it pre-game, pre-event, right? In the London Games. And you did a lot of imagery around that. How much time did you spend thinking about the woman that you want to be when you don't get results?
Actually, quite a bit, because I think, just being in sports, you do see examples of what happens when maybe a person is not being their best self when they have failed. And for me, I think a huge part of it was my parents and just instilling this deep value inside of me and this deep belief system that it doesn't matter whether you're first or you're last, you treat everyone the exact same. Like there's no negotiating that. Like that's just a fundamental piece of who we want you to be and who we know you're capable of being. And so having that opportunity to finally show that and say, okay, in failure, I want to be that same person that I was when I was winning a gold medal and try as hard as it'll be to still inspire people with how I'm handling this. Like that's what I want to strive for.
Okay. So you're trying to be your best, not the best, or do I have that part wrong?
No, that's very accurate. Okay. Always. And that was pretty much my entire career I was only ever focused about being my best. I was never concerned about being the best.
When the gal next to you was a half second, 2 seconds faster than you, what would you do with that?
Nothing.
Come on. Everybody says that.
No, but it's true. I would go back and look at my own race and figure out what I could do to be better next time. But there is never going to be a race. There's never going to be a scenario where I'm going to be able to control the lane next to me or control how she's racing. And so it's like, I'm not going to waste energy trying to figure out what she's doing and how I can beat her when I can instead focus on what I can do to be better. And that is going to be energy used infinitely more wisely because that's something I can control.
How did you learn that?
I think a lot of that came from coaches. I was with my coach, Todd Schmitz, for, 10 years before we went to London. And that was a huge thing that we talked about is, you know, when you're growing up and you're trying to figure it out and you're learning the ropes, you know, I loved to race. And there were several times where I would be the one when I was younger that would just get out there and would just be trying to beat the person next to me. And that led to a lot of conversations and Todd, you know, sitting down and having something very similar to what I just said that, you know, ultimately, what are you capable of? Because if you're only trying to beat the person next to you, when in reality, you could be far ahead of them, but you're not even giving yourself the opportunity to try because you're so focused on them, like that does nothing for you. And it's the same, you know, in a race, if you're behind or if you're ahead, not letting those emotions start to freak you out. Like, did I take it out too fast? Are they going to catch me? Do I have enough to catch them at the end? Like, it has to be about you and the way that you're going to compete and swim your best.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something, it's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. It's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they found is fascinating. Across various real-world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep. 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability. And up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO. apolloneuro.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to aquatrue.com, You spell it AQUATRU.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's aquatrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there.
You know, it's so many people say it, and knowing you, you live it, mm-hmm. and it's true. And even the way that you say it, there's a groundedness to it. And one of the questions, I want to bridge something that you just said a few minutes ago about the principles that sat underneath the way that you would respond to winning and to losing. Mm-hmm. And you weren't practiced at losing. You didn't have a whole lot of practice there. I mean, certainly you didn't always get with the, you know, what you wanted.
Yeah.
But you didn't have on the world stage practice.
No. Okay. Yeah.
So what were the principles that sat underneath that? And then I want to double click and say, like, when did those first start to happen, that those were your principles and not, let's call it, coach's principles or mom's principles or dad's principles?
So I think, honestly, the most basic principle, and I hope this isn't too simplistic, but it was just sportsmanship. It was just respecting the people that you were competing against and the people that were watching you. And, you know, I do think, you know, I was taught it, but I also think quite a bit of it was innate, because we have childhood videos that are hysterical of me swimming in my summer club meets when I'm 5, 6, 7 years old. And I'm literally reaching my hand out to the lane next to me for a handshake after a race. And I will not move until they shake my hand. Like, I refuse. And, you know, a lot of times it takes them a minute. Like, they don't even realize I'm doing it. And then as soon as they do, they'll come over and shake my hand. But, I mean, I am, like, staring at the kid next to me down, like, just waiting. And I think that was so deeply ingrained. And then also, as I was growing up within the sport, the way it would make me feel when I saw other athletes not handle themselves in that manner after a bad race, I think lack of sportsmanship is something that really hurts me. Even if it has nothing to do with me, even if I'm watching it as a complete third party, I just believe in the power of sports so much. And when I see it being almost disrespected in that way, I think it takes away from the bigger picture of what this is all about. It's not about one person's wins. It's not about one person's losses. It's about the power of what we all have to do together. And so not being selfish in those moments when you're crushed and literally in despair, but still recognizing that it's not about you.
Beautifully put. And in when you're in Rio and there's a microphone in front of you and you just came up short from what you had hoped or planned to do, mm-hmm. and people are saying, what happened? And you're sad. Was it more sad or was it more frustration?
I think it was more confusion, than anything else, and just trying to understand what was happening and why. Just why? Like, I think that was just the three-letter word that over and over again, I couldn't find an answer.
Where does the majority of you live? And this is a weird way of saying, like, are you more up in your head, in your heart and chest or stomach or hips?
Like, heart.
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 Yeah. And most people, when they say heart, where do you point when you say heart?
Pretty much all over. I think I'm a very, I feel emotions very strongly. I feel them for myself very strongly. I feel them for other people very strongly. And I do feel them so strongly that it impacts my entire body. So that's why I would say pretty much all over.
Is part of your superpower empathy?
I think so.
Are you able to put words to your emotions and words to other people's emotions?
I've gotten much better at it. It's very similar to imagery. It's something I've had to work at. And I think also because so much of my life was essentially picture perfect. I mean, so wonderful. Grew up in the most loving household. I was successful in sports. I was successful in school. I had a fabulous group of friends. I mean, you know, of course I went through things, but I had such an incredible support system that, you know, it really wasn't until college and Rio and experiencing these kind of life-altering failures that I started to experience emotions that I hadn't experienced before on such an extreme level. And what was crucial for me during that time was not labeling those as good or bad. And it's still something that I'm working on every single day. But I think because being happy and joyful feels so good, and being sad and lonely often doesn't, you tend to have a negative connotation with those. And so it's really taken me a long time to kind of switch that flip a little bit. And instead of labeling them as bad, just recognizing them, like what you're saying, like, oh, I feel a little bit sad today and that's okay. I'm going to feel, you know, exactly how I'm going to feel. And I have the best people in the world that are going to accept me for whatever I'm feeling right now.
How'd you come to learn that? That's not an easy path to follow. Most people don't have the depth of that understanding, let alone the experiences to support it, and at the same time feel like they need to, you've heard me talk about this, do more to be more. Yeah. And like, I need to do extraordinary to be extraordinary. So like, can you walk through just unpacking that just a little bit more?
Absolutely. So I mean, so much of that came from my time after Rio. That was just so, it was the most turbulent time in my life, without a doubt. And I had to learn it essentially because I had no other choice. I was at rock bottom.
What does rock bottom mean?
I mean, just at a point where I didn't want to swim anymore. I was so confused. I felt lost in my own life. I felt completely out of control. And I had just been feeling all of these emotions and had been repressing them for so long that they got to a point where it just completely bubbled over. And I realized I had to deal with them. It wasn't something I could keep pretending like everything was okay. It wasn't something I could just slap a smile on top of and keep pushing forward, because I'd been doing that for so long that finally that smile just broke and it wasn't working as a bandage anymore. And so that's when I started actually like sitting down and working with a therapist, and she was huge for me in terms of, okay, let's like talk about how we're feeling. Let's look at these emotions and stop being so gosh dang hard on yourself, because that was my number one problem. Is I would feel sad or lonely or whatever it was, like a failure. And then I would feel guilty for feeling those things because of how blessed my life was and because of how much I had been given and because of the success that I had had. And I will never forget when I first came out about the depression that I had gone through, and I was still at the point where I, for some reason, didn't know that reading comments on an article is never the thing to do. And I read some of the comments, which were for the most part wonderful and incredible, but there was one that I will never forget, and it was exactly what I was afraid of. And it was someone who came out and said, you know, who does this girl think she is? She has 6 Olympic gold medals and she's depressed. Are you kidding me? And like that is what I would think about every time I got those feelings that I associated with being negative, was like, how dare I? Like, how dare I feel that for everything that I've been given and for this incredible life that I've had? And yet I still feel like this. Like, how could you? And so having to get through that and start treating myself with love and understanding, and recognizing that everyone feels these emotions, regardless of what you've been through, regardless of what kind of a life that you've had. And it's not a comparison scale. You're not only allowed to feel one thing because you've gone through something of a certain stature. It's just understanding one another and being able to put yourself in one another's shoes and just being there for one another.
Jeez. the critic is so intense, you know, the other and self, you know, and it, you know, you have a wonderful smile. It's infectious. You change, you change people when you smile. And it sounds like you use that really well. And sometimes you would use it to authentically express joy. And you probably started to understand the power of your smile early on. Mm-hmm. And then it also sounds like you were using that in maladaptive ways to smile when you really didn't want to smile.
Absolutely.
And yeah. So that was more of your mechanism to not feel.
Yep. 100%. Yeah. And to still try and live up to the expectation of what others wanted to see. They knew me for that smile. You know, Missy without the smile wasn't really Missy. And so,
but Missy with the smile wasn't really Missy.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was just, you know, I think that's where I learned the power of authenticity and just trusting that people, even if I wasn't smiling, would prefer me to be authentic and true to myself and relatable and honest than the Missy that they wanted to see that wasn't true.
Yeah. And more importantly, that's what at some point you wanted. You're like, I can't keep doing this anymore.
Exactly.
Like, this is
and I just really fully recognized the power of authenticity and how that enabled me to connect with people in a way that I had never been able to before.
So scale of like 1 to 100, if we could play this game out a little bit, and let's say 100 is rich, deep, consistent joy. And, zero, it's actually, we should do 100 to -100, you know, and -100 is suicidal, deep, dark loneliness where there feels like there is no out, right? It's the, it's that place. Like, how far did you swing between, or how long did you sit and at what level on the depressed side?
I would probably say like -75. I never got to 100, -100, never got to that point. I think I recognized what was happening and the trajectory I was on and just became so scared that I knew I had to do something. But in terms of how long, I think it really started a few months, even longer, honestly. I think just being on the negative side in general began the year leading up to the 2016 Olympics. And I kind of stayed within the zero and -50 range throughout that entire year. And then once the games were over, that next 6 to 8 months was kind of where that -75 kicked in.
Yeah, looking back, it's so much easier to see it looking back. But at the time, did you have a sense that you were depressed? Or did you think it was, because it can look like a lot of things. Depression.
It really can.
It can look like overtraining. It can, there can be hormonal stuff that comes up, especially for female endurance athletes.
Yeah.
You know, it there can be lots of things. But looking back, did you know that you were depressed at that time?
I don't think so. Definitely not while I was training. And then I actually did get diagnosed with overtraining syndrome in April of 2016. So again, just like you said, that was something that came up. I was like, oh, that's probably why, you know, I've been feeling like this. I've been feeling so down and exhausted and all I want to do is sleep. And I think it probably wasn't until, again, after Rio that I right, everything just kind of went quiet. Like in the lead up to the Olympics, there's nothing quiet about that. There's really no time for you to sit and work through your emotions and what you're feeling. And also you're scared to, because, you know, I had a feeling that something just, I wasn't right. I wasn't this exuberant, joyful, happy, you know, woman that I had always been my whole life. And so I wanted to ignore it because I didn't want to have to address that knowing I had the biggest event of my life coming up in a month, in 2 months. And so then once all of that's over and you're just kind of left in silence, that's really when you're like, okay, what is going on? This is not right.
Did you have somebody in your camp that you were working with? Like maybe it was a psychologist or somebody that was skilled in. Yeah. So was that dialogue was open?
Yes, it was.
Okay, cool.
So I had been working with one throughout Olympic trials and the Olympics.
There you go.
And all through training camp. And that was huge for me.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. So it's not like you were stuffing it, because there is this fear that I think many of us have, which is, you know, oh, I just got to do it the way that I know I've been successful in the past. But the things that we've done in the past are not going to get us necessarily where we want to go. We've got to let go of some of the stuff that we're
Amen to that.
Right? Like, you got to figure that next kind of thing out. And it's hard. You know, that's really hard to do.
Oh, it's because you believe in it and you trust it. And so to go from something that you trust to something that's an unknown, that's a terrifying thing.
Yeah, cool. So if you could go back, let's say, to your last race at Rio, and knowing what you know now, what would you say to yourself prior to that event?
I probably would have said exactly what I had told myself, which was just do your best. And we've talked about what that meant to me and the deeper level that had, you know, in terms of everything. But I knew that my best wasn't good enough that meet. Like, that was painfully evident that my best was just not even close to cutting it. And yet that was all I had to give. I couldn't give more than that. So I just remember getting up and saying, just do your best. And whatever happens, you'll know when you touch the wall, there was nothing else you could have done.
Really cool. And I don't want to change your narrative here, but would you change that event?
No, I wouldn't. And I'm such a firm believer in everything happening for a reason. And I wouldn't change a thing about Rio. I mean, the full 8 days, and I wouldn't change about a thing that happened afterward. But one of my favorite memories from my entire career was in Rio, and it was the night of the final of the women's 200 meter backstroke. So an event that I had failed to final in, that I was watching from the stands, that I was the reigning Olympic and world champion in and current world record holder. And I mean, sitting up there and watching those women walk out and having to see it like that, never in a million years having expected that that was what my 200 backstroke in Rio was going to look like. I got to watch my teammate, Maya Dorado, win and beat out the favorite and get a gold medal. And watching her win that, like, I have goosebumps right now, and just seeing her joy, like, that moment for me, it was a moment I could have never expected, and it's one that I wouldn't change for the world.
I remember that, not that exactly the way you said it, but I remember the narrative of you being in the stands. And when I watched it, I remember thinking, wow, she went to watch.
Yeah.
And so you didn't have to go.
No.
Right.
But and I it was hard. Like, there was a lot of internal conflict on whether or not whether it was going to be best for me, but whether or not I was going to be able to put on enough of a happy face to not take away from the rest of the team that was up there cheering. I didn't want to take anything away from that environment. And I truly didn't know if I was strong enough to go there and put on that smile and put on that face and try and contribute some kind of energy to that group. But ultimately, I knew at the end of the day, my team could get me through anything, and that they were going to give me the strength to get through it. They were going to give me the strength to be there with them and to cheer my heart out for Maya and for everyone else that we had swimming that night. And I owed them at least that much.
Very cool. If parents knew what you knew about becoming the best in the world, but really your path was about becoming your best, and all the costs that come with it, all the joys that are part of it, all the celebrations and the trying to sort it out, the hard times, what would you hope that they could get their arms around, like in a word or a couple sentences or like something that they could understand what you know? What is that?
I think my biggest thing is helping your child understand that their identity is so much bigger than the one thing that they're best at. And that was something my parents did so well that I was never just Missy the swimmer. I was first and foremost Missy their daughter. And then I was Missy the friend. And then Missy the swimmer, Missy the student, Missy whatever it was. They made sure that I knew I had so much more to offer this world than just what I could do in a swimming pool. And eventually down the line, when I again hit Rio and for the first time truly failed and had to experience that, I realized how much of my own self-identity and self-worth I had put into swimming. And so when that was taken away, my world was totally rocked from that. But that was something I had put on myself, even with being completely surrounded. So I would say any kind of emphasis, any kind of environment that you can foster so that your child knows that whether it's sports, whether it's theater, whether it's chess, like if it's school, like whatever it is that they're best at, constantly reassuring them that they still have so much more to offer than just that.
Great insight. I mean, identity foreclosure is so tragic when it gets exposed, and you know, and it, there's lots of ways to expose it, not just loss, but you know, when you lose joy in the thing that you do, but you're supposed to be happy, you know, you had so much of that. And it really is a tragic thing because we're obviously intellectually, we say it so much more than what we do. But it's super, super slippery slope when that thing is abruptly taken away. And okay. So, can you give me a sense of like how you structured the mental skills part of your work? Obviously we got some imagery. What about clarity of goals? What about purpose? What about breathing work? What about mindfulness, self-talk? Like, what about some of those other skills?
Yeah. So goal setting was huge. Goal setting is something I can't say enough about and something that was so important for me. But I would write out my times to the hundredth of exactly what I wanted to do at the end of each season. And I would often hit them exactly or a couple of 100s off. And self-talk was also huge. So I had, I call it a little confidence jar. And so after a really good practice or a really good race or just something that I was really proud of during the season, I would write it down and I would put it in a little jar. And before the big meet, I would, the night before, take out this jar that was chock full of things from the last 10 months that I was really proud of myself for doing. And there was no better way to go into a meet than to have opened up this jar and to read about things you'd completely forgotten about that you just absolutely crushed this practice, or when you really surprised yourself and you were exhausted and yet somehow still like went a time that you really wanted to go in season, or you had the best strength training workout and you're just getting this like overflow of confidence the night before you're heading into a race. And so those were two things I think that were most beneficial for me.
What were you searching for? What was the thing underneath the thing underneath the thing? Like what was, you know, what were you aching for? What were you craving?
Being my best. I mean, I sound like a broken record, but That was it. Like whatever it was, again, end of season, like, and I've said this a couple times in interviews before, but like my goal time was my goal time. If that goal time got me a gold medal, awesome. If that goal time got me eighth place, awesome. I didn't care what place it was. I knew that that was my goal and that was going to be my best. And if I went that, like that's what I was chasing.
And how about now? Because it's so concrete in the pool. I guess it certainly could be the same thing, but like what are you searching for now?
You know, it honestly is so similar, and it's like I talked about earlier, with it being such an applicable theory to so many different areas of your life, it's now, how do I be the best version of myself as a retired athlete? How do I still continue to inspire? How do I still make the difference that I want to make in the world? How do I set goals for myself now? How do I be the best wife that I can be? How do I still continue to be the best daughter? Like, it's all these areas where I love the constant challenge of being my best.
I wouldn't expect anything else from you. It sounds just like what I would imagine. Oh, goodness. Okay. When I mention the word gratitude, what or who comes to mind?
Oh, my gosh. Honestly, right off the bat, my husband. I think there's so many people in my life I have to be grateful for, but I'm going to sound completely mushy and cheesy and gooey, and I'm totally okay with it. But my husband is the best human I've ever known, and I cannot believe I have the privilege of being married to him every single day. But ever since he came into my life, he's changed it.
Awesome. I mean, I would hope that we all have the ability to experience that type of depth in relationship. And when you say those things, where did you feel them?
Oh, all over.
There it is. Back at it.
You knew.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Yeah. And then what happens behind your eyes?
Honestly, it just, I kind of just want to close them. Like, it's just the emotions are almost so overpowering that, like, I need to shut off other senses, because I just want to like feel how wonderful those feelings are.
Very cool. Okay. So Miss, I just want to say thank you, like, for being available to talk about not only the celebrations in your life and the things that you've done to organize your life and the mental skills you've used, but also the darker side, the harder side where, you know, it's scratchy, it's lonely, it's, there's irritation, you know, and to also say, hey, listen, you can have medals and also still feel those things.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, just, there's no privilege, there's no walk of life that escapes the psychological and emotional difficultness of being a human, right? Yeah. There are certainly things that can make it easier, but that doesn't change the narrative about how it actually feels to be human. And I'm saying that with the greatest sensitivity to people that have much and don't have much.
Yeah.
Or maybe even nothing at all. And so the human experience is complicated and it's beautiful, and you've got range. And this is one of the reasons I wanted to spend so much time with you. So thank you. And then also, are there some things that you would hope the next generation could get right? And those folks that are listening and watching you, to say, maybe there's one, two, three things that you're like, just pay attention to or get great at, or, you know, how would you finish those thoughts?
I will also just want to say thank you for having me and for providing a platform for me to be honest and authentic and open, and for so many others to do the same. I'm so grateful for you and for what you've done. And in terms of the next generation, I think you said it really beautifully, that there is such a range of human experience. And instead of comparing ourselves to one another on that range, just entering that with compassion and with empathy and understanding. And I talked about it briefly earlier, but it's not about whether or not someone's gone through more than you, or whether or not someone's lost more or gained more. It's just about being human together and just feeling what we feel together, and knowing that we all experience these emotions based on so many different things and so many different life events, and on such a spectrum that, you know, if we can just approach each other more with compassion, like, I think that is what I would want to see the most.
Oh, God. Like, honestly, yes. Because, like, I'm listening going, you know, something is just really special about you. And it is that your honesty and authenticity, but then the depth of that statement, that heartfelt approach, we are more disconnected and have a higher rate of loneliness than just two generations ago. Yeah. It's an all-time defragmentation of our institutions and our relationships. And I don't know if you know the stats on it, but what you just said, I think you lived and learned. And I want the same.
Yeah, right?
I want the same, yeah. Okay, so last kind of question. How do you define or articulate or even think about this concept of mastery?
I think of mastery as always, this is very typical Missy fashion, you're going to laugh at me, is always striving to be your best while recognizing that you're never going to get there. Mm. And I think there's a lot to unpack there, but ultimately and simplistically just realizing that, you know, I never want to be done challenging myself. I never want to be finished trying to be my best. I refuse to ever stop growing and trying and seeing what I'm capable of doing. Like, I refuse to believe that there is a best self to get to, because it's just a journey with no destination. And the prize in and of itself is that journey.
What an ambassador for kindness and authenticity and the goal being the path rather than the goal being the outcome and being celebrated for having special talents. Like, wonderful. And so, where can people follow you? Where can people find you? Where can, you know, our tribe, you know, merge with your tribe?
Yes, I'm a big Insta girl. That's my big one. All of them, I have everything, but it's a little too much for me to handle. So I am mainly on Instagram. It's at MissyFranklin88. And then my Twitter is at MissyFranklin. But Instagram is definitely where you're going to see the most personal and authentic Missy posts.
There's a reason you're a legend. Thank you again, Missy.
Likewise. Thank you so much. This has been absolutely wonderful.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well. Think well and keep exploring.